Louisville will have a new chief prosecutor next year, and his name is Tom Wine. I'm Phillip Bailey, and this is Noise and Notes. Wine stepped down as an appeals court judge to run for Commonwealth's attorney. He won that four-way primary and sailed to victory in the fall election. Yeah. Now Wine is set to take the reins as residents and city officials begin to focus more on the causes and consequences of violent and organized crime. I talked to Wine about his recent staff changes, imminent state budget cuts, and issues with protecting witnesses.
I think they deserve, number one, public safety. Number two, that we prosecute the guilty. And number three, we protect the innocent. And I think that's very important that prosecutors remember their job is not to convict. Their job is to get the bad guys and get the ones that really are guilty. And unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. I'm not making any accusations of the current administration, but sometimes prosecutors can get focused, too focused, that they tunnel vision. Police officers get tunnel vision. I read a book recently called Convicting the Innocent by Brandon Garrett, and it's basically looks at some cases that Project Innocence has dealt with, and the number of times when people felt this is the guy who committed the crime and ignored all evidence to the contrary, and the guy who committed the crime was still out there committing crime.
You ran in a four-way primary. You won that, I think, with like 37%, 32% of the vote, somewhere in there. How important is it for you, politically speaking, though, since that you didn't get a majority, and it was a four-way race,
right,
where you get like 32% of the vote, less than a third, how important is for you to reach out to maybe your opponent's supporters and bring them into this administration and make them feel comfortable? Or is it simply the matter of, no, this is less of a political position and more of a legal position that we just happen to vote on?
Right. Yeah, first of all, I really do believe, having served for 20 years as a nonpartisan, that the Office of Commonwealth Attorney should also be nonpartisan. I don't think it should matter if you're Democrat or Republican, Green Party, Libertarian, or whatever. Criminals don't care if you're a registered Democrat or a registered Republican.
And there's also the question of how does a Republican prosecute crime differently than a Democrat necessarily?
And probably there's no difference at all. Because again, if their goals are public safety, prosecuting the guilty, and protecting the innocent as it should be, it doesn't matter your party affiliation.
One of the first decisions you have made was to let go of five prosecutors and six staffers from your predecessor's tenure. I know you've said in prior interviews that you view that decision as your prerogative, but what was the basis of that personnel decision, if you don't mind sharing?
I think every elected official who goes in wants to have people that he or she is most comfortable with. And it's not a reflection on the individuals that you say goodbye to, necessarily, but it's a reflection on your desire to have people that you're comfortable with and that you've worked with before in those positions. And I think when we see ultimately what unfolds, and I was kind of in a difficult position, I had to, as agreed to with the current Commonwealth Attorney, Mr. Stengel, was going to announce early so these people would have an opportunity to find jobs. You know, when Mr. Stengel came in, he basically said, you six or seven are gone this afternoon. He gave him 6 hours notice, and that was his prerogative. I gave him 7 weeks notice. So that was my, an opportunity to give them a chance to find jobs. And at the same time, to start building the team that I wanted to bring on and to reach out with people that I've worked with before. We've got some great people coming in, and because some of them still are advising clients and that, I can't reveal all that information.
So you're going to replace those 11 staffers with not all 11?
I'm going to replace as many as I can, and here's the other problem. And Mr. Stengel had been faced with this very same problem. Our budget in the next biennium is going to be cut perhaps as much as 5%. Now, in an office that 97% of your budget is personnel, there's only one place that cut can come from, and that's personnel.
And that would affect, obviously, your ability to do the job when you don't have as many prosecutors. Those who are there have to take on heavier caseloads. I mean, that presents a whole new set of problems.
Well, there's one or two ways to approach it, and I'm going to discuss this with the staff when we go in on January 1. One way is exactly what you said. Just don't replace those people or even lay people off if necessary. The second option is across-the-board cuts of 5% in terms of payroll. And I think we have to examine that option as well.
That seems to be a no-win situation. Either you pay really good people less or you, as you mentioned, spread that out across and make people take on more of a workload.
Right.
But one of the staffers who was fired was Tom Bandarostein. Now, he was one of your primary opponents, and as you said, you don't think that these races should necessarily be partisan, but he was in charge of many high-profile and controversial cases. Some have said in the legal field his handling of those cases and his criticisms of you during the campaign had something to do with his removal.
Well, and again, and I've tried to be very fair about this, and maybe this gets back to what you've described as being straight-laced. I'm trying to be very fair. Mr. Vandy Rostai and I obviously had a different viewpoint of who should become Wilt's attorney. And that's not wrong. Carol Cobb, who also ran in that race, I've asked to stay on.
And there's a big difference, though, between Mr. Vandy Rostai and Ms. Cobb's campaign, right? I mean, his campaign, like you said, in these partisan races, he ran attack ads, not just think against you, but other your other opponents in the race.
Against all three of the other opponents.
Exactly. And, I mean, raising this issue of double dipping and pensions and that matter, I mean, that... And I noticed in your campaign speech, once you had won, you had thanked your other two opponents, but not Vandy Rostai. So there is a political bad blood there, right? Right.
Well, first of all, again, we got to be careful of the word partisan, because we think about that being Democrat and Republican. We're all four Democrats.
That was all four Democrats.
So it was not political in that sense that we were trying to push out a certain party. That didn't happen. But you have to have confidence in the people that you're working with. And as I said, Mr. Vandy Rostai actually had a lot. He and I had difference of opinions about how that office was to be run. For example, I'm in favor of looking at more criminal mediation and resolving cases. He was not. I was interested in looking at a different way of approaching death penalty cases. I think that we need to be concerned with, not only is a person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but will a jury give the death penalty in this case? And that's not the current policy of the office, and he said that was a policy he was going to follow. So we had differences about where we believed.
So it was less bad blood and more just philosophical differences?
I know you said, well, you can't talk about Carol Cobb, but you have to. I mean, Carol Cobb had some differences about things as well, and I understand that, but she and I ultimately came together and said, we can work together on this. I didn't feel that with Mr. Vandy Rostai. And like I said, I know he's got a lot of criticism about cases that he's handling. He's going to have to deal with that in another forum. And again, I don't know all there is to know about those cases, so it would be unfair for me to make an opinion or state publicly an opinion about that. But I still want prosecutors who come in with as little baggage as possible.
Well, not wanting to get you to comment on too many specifics, but I'd like to talk about a few trials and some of the legal issues that have popped up as a result. The first involves the death of Troya Shekels. It was one of the more disturbing cases. I remember I wrote about it in Leo a few years ago when I worked at Leo. Shekels was a 31-year-old woman who was a key witness in a 2006 homicide of her boyfriend. 3 years later, I guess she finally began to cooperate with law enforcement, but she was fatally shot, murdered in broad daylight at Shelby Park. Now, I see these ads with Metro Police encouraging people to come forward when they are witnesses to crime. But what assurances are there from both your office and the police that you can protect witnesses from reprisal?
You know, that's an age-old problem. It hasn't just happened. I mean, we've heard stories for years about, you know, organized crime, getting rid of witnesses.
And this was a pretty public execution, though.
I understand. And we've also, you know, have to deal with that, and you're absolutely right. The problem that you have, though, is we don't have the resources to be everywhere to protect everyone. And I think your viewers have to consider this. They say, well, if I'm a witness to a crime, I'm not going to come forward because I could get killed. Well, is there any guarantee that as a witness to the crime and you don't come forward, that whoever it was that you saw commit that crime knows about you and they're not going to take the chance?
But isn't it true in state cases that your name is included in the docket? I mean, that was a situation involving the
There are discovery provisions that require that we reveal eyewitnesses, and we give identifying information.
So I'm assured that my name will be out there if
Somewhere, unless we can show, I mean, if there have been threats made against that individual, we may be able to protect them as far as their location and make them available. And I think this is one of the things you explore, make them available to the other side, but under a controlled situation.
So you're aware of the state's witness protection program then?
There is, by statute, a state witness protection program, but the problem is they're almost out of money.
Exactly. I mean,
they're almost out of money.
And for those who don't know, in 1998, the Kentucky General Assembly created a state witness protection program with a one-time funding of $200,000. I checked with the Attorney General's office this week. They told WFPL that that number has now dwindled to $28,000. So we're not adequately funding.
No.
And that witness protection program is not like the federal program. We're not giving you a new identity, but some of the provisions are you could have a police escort to and from work, to and from your residence, a police escort watching your residence, or in some extreme cases, relocating to another county for up to 6 months. it seems, though, that there's this burden on the witness more than anyone else to carry that burden of, if I've seen a violent crime, I know my name could potentially be out there for reprisal if I cooperate with law enforcement. It might not necessarily be out there if I don't.
Well, and again, I can't tell you in every situation that a person who doesn't come forward is any safer than someone who does. And I understand what you're saying. You know, if I just turn a blind eye and walk away, maybe I'll be all right. But will you be? And who's going to protect you then if we only have you on our radar? So I think that's an issue, though, again, we take up with our legislature. And the Commonwealth Attorneys Association has talked about that and feels like they need to go to them again and say, look, we need to refund, we need to fund this program further because of these situations like Toya Shekels. We need to come forward and say we will provide as much as we can. But, you know, it's just like a domestic violence order. If you as a woman have been abused by your husband or boyfriend or whatever live-in, you go to get a domestic violence, you go for an EPO, you get a domestic violence order, it's a piece of paper. You still have to protect yourself and be careful, but at least the law is trying to help you and providing you with some resources, and hopefully we can do that. And like you said, if it's a matter of relocating somebody or providing some escorts, hopefully that'll be enough. But if you don't...
So you would advocate for that more funding you put in that program?
Absolutely. And I think there are ways that we can do that. I mean, again, you know, we...
Well, as the state is beginning to cut and you're seeing furlough days at the courthouse, doesn't look too bright. The case of alleged trigger man Ricky Kelly was another case that sort of caught my attention and many people's attention. It was both brutal and fascinating. Here's a guy who's alleged, who's facing the death penalty with multiple murder charges. He's alleged to be the muscle for one of the largest drug organizations in the city of Louisville. Your predecessor, Mr. Stengel, said this, quote, he's the most frightening person I've come across in 30 years of law enforcement. The Kelly case was riddled with reports of organized crime. I think this case begs the question, does Louisville have a gang problem?
Well, I think, first of all, as you know, the Ricky Kelly case was indicted by the Jefferson County Grand Jury and ultimately was sent to the U.S. Attorney's Office, so it's being prosecuted as a federal case. They have some tremendous resources there that we do not always enjoy.
And I want to ask you about that, too, because the Courier-Journal's Jason Riley, he reported that, quote, state prosecutors were so concerned about the safety of witnesses that they dropped their charges against Kelly so he could be pursued in federal court. I mean, part of the problem was that state prosecutors were worried about Kelly and his organization's ability to get to witnesses, whether to intimidate or to kill them. I mean, that exactly the same sort of issue we talked about with Troy Shekels.
And again, what we said earlier, the federal government has vast resources. You know, there's a certain advantage being able to print your own money that we don't enjoy here in the state. So the federal government has vast resources that we don't enjoy.
But that would seem to add to the argument that it's – and I don't think necessarily people are – I mean, I think that as LMPD has pointed out to in past reporting, people in this city cooperate with 574 LMPD at a high rate. Some of their best cases have been broken by people calling in that anonymous tip line. So people are cooperating. There is that question of, and this Kelly case was a prime example of the state being unable to protect people to the point where the state dropped its case against Kelly and handed it over to the feds because we can't protect the witnesses.
Well, again, and I understand what you're saying, and I understand also that it doesn't matter who gets credit for taking somebody like Mr. Kelly out so long as we take Mr. Kelly out. And that has to, again, number one, protect the public, as I said earlier. And here's an opportunity to do that through the federal government.
Does his case reveal that there is an issue with organized crime?
I don't know if it reveals that there's an issue of organized crime. Again, I don't have all the particulars of that case. I mean, quite frankly, I understand Mr. Vandy Rostein was the original prosecutor on that case, and I think probably wisely so. He's not said a lot about those things as well. You know, you don't want to tip your hand completely until you're required to by law. But even if there is organized crime, I don't think that is a reason for us to shudder. I think that's a reason for us to band together. And our resources, both the state and local and the federal, you know, there's more of
us
than
there is a disconnect here. We're seeing in the newspaper some of these high-profile, important cases that you're about to take over in this important law enforcement role in the city. At the same time, state government cutting your office by 5%.
Well, state government is going to have to make a decision, as all governments need to make a decision, and that's where you're going to put your resources. And, you know, it unfortunate, but I don't believe that the governor is oblivious to this. Steve Beshear is a former attorney general. He's aware of the problems with crime fighting. Jack Conway is a strong advocate for crime fighting. None of these people are unaware of it, but again, they're trying to look to see where we can make best uses of our resources, as we are at our office. I mean, if I don't put somebody in, it's going to be one of those positions that would be nice to have, but I'm going to do without. I mean, somebody's asked me to be a spokesperson for the office. Well, you know, what's a spokesperson going to cost me? $50,000? I can get a prosecutor and a secretary for $50,000. So we've got to look to where we spend our resources.
Another issue that came up, and people who are aware that I was going to interview you were asking this question as well, was the issue of expunging felony records. This came up, obviously, during Mr. Stengel's tenure as well. He fired a prosecutor over that. Where do you stand on expunging convictions?
Okay, well, first of all, and I think Mr. Stengel acted appropriately because someone was expunging records by engaging in a practice that was not sanctioned by the office.
Well, now, just to give background, the fire prosecutor, attorney Felicia Newman, she argued in the newspaper and in public that the state law allows convictions to be set aside and expunged for extraordinary circumstances. She also says that that was something that was going on in Mr. Stengel's office previously, just to give her side of the controversy.
And as far as I know, although she said it was going on by other people, we haven't identified anyone else that's doing that. Now, I'm not saying they're not. Again, I'm not there, so I don't know what's going on. But the purpose of 6002, when you set aside a judgment, is because that judgment is no longer applicable, that it no longer should have application. Something has changed. Something's totally different. To set it aside to allow somebody an opportunity to expunge a case, I don't know if it meets that qualifier. So I would be concerned about how 6002s were being used. Now, that being said, we have engaged openly in the past, and I've been a judge where this has been done, where the prosecutor agrees that after a certain period of time, the defendant can come back and file a 6002 motion and can set aside that conviction so it can be expunged. But that was signed off by the judge, the prosecutor, defense counsel in open court. The things that Ms. Newman respectfully were doing were not things that apparently were part of the original agreement, and those may not have all been her cases. So that's a question, too. That aside, your question about expungements, I am in favor that if someone has, the way the law is currently set up, that if someone has successfully completed and done what they've been asked to do, and we have dismissed those charges, to allow them to expunge that. My concern about expungements, though, is a practical matter. Once that information about your conviction is part of the public record, and once some third party has bought that public record, which they do for purposes of record checks, there's no obligation right now that they go back and clean up all their records. So even though the law says that a person, once a case is dismissed, can have those charges expunged and can tell a future employer, I have no record, by law, that's what they're entitled to do. When that employer doesn't go down to the local police station to do a record check, but goes online and takes a look at that third party, there that conviction shows up.
In that same vein, then, I'd like to know, where do you stand on this issue, and this has come up in the General Assembly often, of restoring felons' voting rights once they've served their time? Do you have a position on that?
Well, those are first of all, two totally different issues.
Yes.
Okay. And, I mean, expungement is talking about someone who's had, and right now under our law.
And the reason I bring that up is because Newman argued that one of the reasons she was doing it was that people who had changed their life, turned their life around, were still being punished for crimes they had committed years ago, and part of the reason is Kentucky is one of the few states that do not automatically restore.
One of two states, I understand.
that don't automatically restore a person's voting rights and civil rights once they're released from prison for a felony conviction.
Okay. Well, again, just so we're clear, expungement, usually misdemeanors, usually felonies that are dismissed as opposed to where they've served their time. Restoration of civil rights to an individual who has completed their time, who has been released from probation, who has made all the required payments that they're supposed to on restitution, has done everything that we've asked, and it does not involve violent crimes, sexual offenses, crimes against children, I have no problem when the legislature comes back and says, let's go ahead and restore their civil rights immediately.
This came up a few years ago. First 48. It was a television program. It's on A&E right now, and it was filming here in Louisville for a few years. The police department enjoyed that relationship, it seemed, and enjoyed the exposure, but it seemed to complicate the prosecution of cases. They no longer have a contract. The police department no longer has a contract with First 48 now. Would you discourage LMPD Chief Steve Conrad from renewing that relationship?
I think there is always a danger, human nature being what it is, knowing that we may someday be on television or in a television show or the subject of a book. Anything that impedes an officer or a prosecutor from doing their duty, which is to fully investigate a case and to explore all leads and to make sure that we are convicting people who are guilty and in turn turning over exculpatory evidence, any of those things that would impede that progress, I would be opposed to. I'm not familiar with the terms of the contract with the first 48 hours or the next 24 or whatever program they come up with because there's so many outlets now and so much time to fill. But I would be concerned if we're trying to make stars out of people who are doing their job, and I think sometimes that happens.
One of your campaign pledges that I do remember was to review cases that use jailhouse informants, for lack of a better term, what they're called in the street, snitches. It's always interesting that the streets and the courthouse have very different terms for the same exact groups of people. What's the specific reason you are proposing that change?
I am very concerned when a person comes forward and says, Joe Blow just confessed to me the most horrendous crime ever committed. And Joe Blow doesn't know the snitch. Why in the world would somebody who has committed this crime confess to a complete stranger? I think we have to be extraordinarily careful. In fact, I would almost say we need to discourage that. When an individual implicates themselves in the same crime and says, I and Joe Blow committed this crime, that's a different story. That's going to give some credibility to that person's testimony because they have now implicated themselves.
This issue has come up in debates both legally in law school and I think I've seen it in the public square as well. The philosophical implications of law enforcement working with some criminals to catch other criminals on the basis of reduced sentences or time off or compensation of some sort for information they may or may not have.
I think the federal model is one that we need to more closely align ourselves to, and that is that when an individual comes to you with information and they're seeking a deal, you make them no deals. You give them the opportunity to testify, and after they testify, you evaluate that testimony, and it's not whether you win or lose based upon that testimony, but if they've given truthful testimony and you can prove that, you may then want to make a deal with them. But until that time, no deals are made. And as you know, we've had some situations where deals have been made. Testimony has not been locked in. We don't have a written confession. We don't have a written testimony. We don't have a tape statement. And then an individual is free to totally repudiate what they allegedly said in order to get their freedom. And like I said, if the motivation can only be tracked back to, I want to get out, those are not individuals I want to have in court. If that's all my case stands on, then I'm going to take it and have to look somewhere else.
I'd like to know then, to sort of wrap all this up, this year sort of started off with a string of shootings in the Parkland neighborhood. We've talked about this on this show before with different guests. Mayor Greg Fisher has announced the creation of this violence prevention director. What are your thoughts on the new position? Will it conflict with your position at all? Will it add something to it? What are your thoughts on carving out funds for that new position?
Well, again, that's certainly Mayor Fisher's prerogative. I am willing to work with anyone. Obviously with the police chief, with the county attorney, the new
But is that position necessary, though?
Well, again, I guess we need to see what the job description is, and we need to see what this person brings to the table, what his or her experiences are. If every problem were a nail, all I need is a hammer. This is something totally different, and we need to be – I've had a chance to actually go down to Parkland and work with the Parkland Boys and Girls Club. I've gone down there and – because quite frankly, I've got a strong back and a weak mind. So I've been able to go down there and do yard work and painting and helping to set up when they did the playground and that. I think it's important that as an elected official, after the election, because I had somebody say to me, what are you doing down here? The election's over. This is my community, and I want to reach out. So I want people in the community, wherever they are, when I come to them and say, I need you to be a witness, for them to come back and say, and not me personally, but my whole staff, for them to come back to say, you were there for us. I'm not afraid to come forward and talk to you. And I think that's one way that we do it. So if Mayor Fisher can use a violence coordinator who brings everybody to the table, more power to him. I hope it works, because this is our community. And we can't just, as I said earlier, it doesn't matter who gets the credit, federal government, state, local. If we beat the problem back, and I'm going to misquote him, but I think it was Ronald Reagan who said, you'd sure be surprised what you can get done when you don't ask for the credit.
And, well, you know it's real when a Democrat starts quoting Ronald Reagan. Tom Wine, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Philip.